Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, the public debate around White House deliberations on what to do next in Afghanistan can have a simple unreality about it. Stay, go, win, lose, defeat the Taliban, bomb Al-Qaeda. Up close, reality is much more complicated, and not all options look open. This hour, On Point, we'll talk with correspondents who've been reporting on the ground about the realities facing the United States and its Afghanistan decision. You can join the conversation. What do you say? More troops? Fewer troops? Steady as she goes? And why? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us first today from Kabul, capital of Afghanistan, is Laura King, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Laura King, thanks very much for being here. How aware is Kabul of the deliberations going on right now in the White House over U.S. troop levels and the future?
Well, I would have to say that people here are much more consumed with their own domestic political drama, which is going on. That is the presidential election that is still undecided almost 2 months after the vote took place.
Is there a sense that Karzai may end up out of power, or that's a done deal? Does it still really seem up in the air?
No, most people think that ultimately he will prevail, but he may have to face a runoff with his main challenger, Abdullah Abdullah.
And what about the state of the conflict there? The conversation here is all about counterinsurgency or going after Al-Qaeda, but we're reading about a lot of Taliban activity lately. Is there a sense of who's winning, who's losing this fight, this conflict in Afghanistan?
Well, what you hear from ordinary people is just that everyone feels very insecure in their daily lives, whether they're here in the capital, Kabul, or out in the hinterlands. And there are large parts of the country where the Taliban really have pretty much asserted control. A few days ago, I was up in the north in Kunduz province, where the Taliban have a shadow government. They have their own court system, and people are afraid.
Afraid, but obviously somebody's supporting the Taliban. And the Taliban, by all accounts, seems to be, its influence, its sway seems to be growing basically week by week.
In certain parts of the country, that is certainly true. And, of course, with the new counterinsurgency strategy put forth by General McChrystal, there are some remote areas of the country that U.S. troops are pulling back from now, in Nuristan province, for example. And again, people in these areas seem to feel that once the U.S. troops are gone, that there is really nothing to prevent the Taliban from taking over altogether.
What about the big push earlier in the year from the Obama administration to get more civilians in the field, working on non-military goals? Are they still able to travel freely around Afghanistan to work on agriculture or the economy or anything else?
No, development projects are seriously threatened by the level of violence and by the insurgency. Any effects that would be seen from the civilians, well, even U.S. diplomats are not calling it a civilian surge. They're calling it an uplift. But the effects of that will not be seen for some time. As far as development work that is going on out in the field now, though, again, in this northern province where I traveled a few days ago, the Germans, who are doing most of the development there, had just finished building a new bridge, and the Taliban promptly blew it up.
And the redeployment you mentioned of American forces from some of these distant outposts to where? Is this to come back into urban areas? Are we headed toward a kind of garrison cities and towns in Afghanistan?
Yes, apparently the push is going to be to try to make sure that the population centers are secure, with the thinking being that if the cities do not feel relatively safe, then there is not going to be a sense of safety anywhere. But as I say, some of the people out in the hinterlands that are being essentially abandoned, feel that way, feel abandoned.
Laura King in Kabul, Afghanistan, for the Los Angeles Times, joining us today. Laura, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks.
Here's sound from a new PBS documentary airing tonight, Obama's War, Marines in the Field Under Fire.
Down, down, down!
The pressure is real, the fight is real, and joining us right now from New York, we're joined by documentary filmmaker Martin Smith. He's won 4 Emmys, 3 George Polk Awards. His frontline films include Return of the Taliban, In Search of Al-Qaeda, and Hunting Bin Laden. His new frontline film, Obama's War, premieres tonight on PBS. It is a great and compelling piece of work. Martin Smith, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
You and your cameraman have been all around Helmand Province, talking with key actors in Kabul, in Pakistan. How are you looking at the debate in Washington right now over more troops or fewer troops, Martin? I have to say, previewing your documentary, watching U.S. troops trying to pull something off in the field here, it looked as though it looked practically impossible to do what they've been tasked to do.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a big difference between listening to folks in the Pentagon or State Department or in the various think tanks in Washington when they talk about counterinsurgency, protecting the people, separating the people from the Taliban. That's one thing. And what it really looks like on the ground and feels like. So that's what we set out to do in the program, is to first go to Washington, listen to the doctrine, and then go out and test it.
Take us to that Helmand village town where your Echo Company 2nd Battalion 8th Marine Regiment set up to try and sort of change the situation, to push the Taliban out and build a new reality. Give us a sense of how that was going as you were filming in July, Martin.
Well, it's very interesting. They moved in to a little village called Mian Poshte in southern Helmand. It's the southernmost point to which Marines have pushed. And they moved in next door to a market, and they took over an old schoolhouse from the Taliban after some heavy fighting on their initial push in there. Lost a Marine on the first day, but after that they established themselves right next door to this market, and I came in there and was very interested in this because I had heard General Petraeus talk about the importance of moving in next door to markets, to population centers. The first day on the ground there, we went into the market to see that there were no shops open, no people there. Just one shopkeeper had come in to pick up some goods out of his shop and get quickly out of there. So the people are fearful of being anywhere near the Americans because they know they will be attacked. The Americans will be attacked as well as they will be attacked for having anything to do with that market at this point. So it sounded good in Washington when General Petraeus talked about it, but on the ground it was a much different reality.
We'll look at that reality. Here's a clip from Obama's War, Martin Smith's new documentary airing tonight on PBS. This is Marine Sergeant Christopher McDonald, and he's standing in this dusty, desolate, nearly abandoned town, talking with a cluster of Afghans there, asking them why people are afraid to come back to their homes. He's dealing with a translator who doesn't know the local dialect. His English isn't strong either. You can hear just how tough this kind of communication is. Here's McDonald and the translator.
Haven't gone where during the fighting?
They haven't gone to, sir.
Gone where? You're not telling me where. Where haven't they gone?
They haven't gone to from here. They haven't
gone from where? Gone where from here? Where? So now it's over there. They just said it was over there.
Yeah.
They're here, they're there. Where are they? The U.S. Marine. Martin, paint a picture for listeners, if you would, of this scene and what this young U.S. serviceman is up against here.
Well, this Marine goes out on regular patrols, as all of them do there in Echo Company. And on a daily basis, they're fired upon by the Taliban or by criminal gangs or drug dealers. It's a major poppy growing area for production of heroin. They don't even see the insurgents that are firing at them. But then he's at the same time tasked with going and talking to villagers and trying to persuade them to rid themselves of the Taliban somehow and come to the side of the Americans. Now, these villagers are not they're not stupid. They're taking a look at this very carefully and thinking, well, this guy's here today. He goes back to his base tonight, and the Taliban are here in the evening. So they're very wary of this. And they're, in the long term, of course, very wary of whether or not they'll be a permanent presence of soldiers here. So they're hedging their bets.
He ends up in these conversations that we've pieced together some excerpts here. He's almost at one point chewing out the villagers for not being more cooperative, but you've described exactly their dilemma. Here's Sergeant McDonald again, standing in front of this group of Helmand villagers in Afghanistan.
Why are you going to Lockery? The market right here is open.
It's also Taliban told, if you go to bazaar, we will kill all of you.
So you were told the Taliban is going to shoot you if you go to the market. Who told you the Taliban was going to shoot you if you go to the market? Who told you all you'd be shot if you go to the market?
Hey, they didn't answer my question.
Listen to me for a second. Listen to me right now, all right? You all are not cooperating.
You all are not cooperating. Orders from Washington, there's the reality on the ground. Martin Smith, my heart went out to that soldier, that Marine. This looked like a nearly impossible job.
These guys are, as announced by the lieutenant colonel that puts them on this mission at the very top of the program, he says, make no mistake, we're experts in the application of violence. And that is what these guys are trained to do. But now they're being asked to be anthropologists, sociologists, or in the words of one officer, armed diplomats. If the idea is to win hearts and minds, it's very difficult to expect that these guys being fired at on a regular basis, who many of them don't quite get the idea of counterinsurgency, to be asked to do this. So on the ground, yes, it looks very, very different than the policy that sounds pretty good in Washington.
And just on the other side of the outskirts of this village, 100 miles of Taliban-controlled territory toward the Pakistan border. Martin Smith, filmmaker whose frontline documentary Obama's War airs tonight. Please stand by. We'll come back and be joined by Pam Constable of the Washington Post. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the looming Afghanistan decision and the reality it faces on the ground. We've been talking with Martin Smith, correspondent at the heart of the new frontline documentary Obama's War, premiering tonight on PBS. You will learn a lot in 60 minutes. He talks with policymakers back in Washington. Then the cameras go to the field, and it is a very, very tough challenge that they depict. Here's the policymaker end of it, retired Lieutenant Colonel John Nagle, who helped write General David Petraeus' counterinsurgency manual. Here he's arguing America needs to send in more troops. Listen to his ideal number.
By classic counterinsurgency measures, success in Afghanistan would require 600,000 counterinsurgents. We're well below half that right now.
Are you saying there have to be more American troops on the ground?
Initially, there need to be more American troops on the ground. The long-term answer and our exit strategy is more Afghan troops on the ground.
John Nagle, policymaker, right at the heart of America's counterinsurgency strategy. 600,000, the ideal number, a classic counterinsurgents in Afghanistan right now, he says. Of course, 40,000 is the proposal from General McChrystal. There's talk of 60 or 80,000 troop expansion options also floating out there. Martin Smith joins us today from New York City. We're joined right now as well from Connecticut, Essex, by Pamela Constable, correspondent for The Washington Post. She's been covering India, Pakistan, Afghanistan since 1998. She's based now in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Pam Constable, thank you very much for being with us.
Delighted to be with you, Tom.
You've recently been up north of Kabul talking with people there about American troops and how they feel about Americans coming in heavier or potentially going, and you found a lot of conflicted opinions, Pam.
Yes, I think Afghans are at this point, I would say, as confused and conflicted about all of this as are the American and Western policymakers trying to figure out what to do. Afghans will tell you in one breath that they're very angry and resentful at the behavior of Western troops. They feel that the troops are abusing civilians and that there's far too many casualties caused by U.S. and NATO airstrikes. And that they want the troops to leave. And then in the next breath, they'll tell you, but if they do leave, the country's going to fall apart and we're going to be overrun and there's going to be civil war. So you get literally from the same people in the same conversation this very strong sense of bewilderment, confusion, tension, and contradiction about what they even wish for.
Pam, you've also been reporting from neighboring Pakistan, looking at the Mullah Omar and the sort of reserve army of potential insurgents that have now massed in Afghanistan. The depth of that looks kind of overwhelming. When you talk with Afghans, do they think that one side or another is winning here? Do they think the Taliban can be defeated by foreign troops?
Absolutely not. I mean, I would say that, 99% of the Afghans that I've spoken with in recent months have said that the only solution to this conflict is negotiation, and that there's no way the Taliban can be defeated militarily. And I think it's important to point out that for most Afghans, the Taliban is not some sort of alien foreign movement. It is a homegrown movement born from their same religion and born out of a civil war that was destroying the country, and that these guys came in to try and pacify. So even though the Taliban have a reputation for very cruel methods of enforcing their version of Islam, it's not such an alien idea to many Afghans, especially to their fellow ethnic Pashtuns, who are a majority of the country.
Martin Smith, in your work, in your film, you're describing or finding the American goal here in some senses being the transformation of an entire society, ancient society. You sat down with General Stanley McChrystal, who was warned of mission failure if he doesn't have more troops, quite publicly. And you asked him directly if a military organization can really change a whole society. Here he is.
It is ambitious, but it's also important. And it's one step at a time. It's a big job, and it's enormously complex, and there will be as many frustrations as there are times when you think you got it right. But I think there's no alternative.
No alternative. Is that what he's saying, Martin Smith, that the U.S. troops have to change society inside out nearly, and there's no alternative?
I was struck by his answer. I really didn't expect him to go on so gung-ho about the project. I had asked him exactly, isn't this overwhelmingly ambitious to think that you can re-engineer an entire society and all its dynamics, governance, security, and whatnot, and that you as a military organization can do this? And without skipping a beat, he said, yeah, it's ambitious and it's going to be hard, but there is no alternative to doing that. He is following orders that he was given to undertake a counterinsurgency strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And the troop request is based on pursuing counterinsurgency. But I think what's going on now, we talk about should there be more troops or not. The question behind that is, what's the objective here? Is the objective nation building as they are talking about doing right now or attempting to do right now? Or is it to prevent another 9/11? And is nation building therefore necessary in order to prevent another 9/11?
Pam Costa, how do you look at that question? It seems to be central to the Obama deliberations right now. Nation building and preventing another Al-Qaeda-sponsored terror attack on the United States. How do these fit together in your mind, or do they?
I do think that that nation building, in a sense, although I would differ slightly on that definition, is crucial to stopping this insurgency and to preventing further widening of the Islamic terrorist threat, not necessarily directly to the United States, but certainly in that region, as we've seen from numerous recent horrific attacks in next door Pakistan. But I'd like to get back briefly to the previous issue of try to transform Afghan society through military and its civilian support means. I think it's an impossible task, an almost impossible task, and I'm not sure that that's really the right approach. I think it's a society that is traditionally very defiant of international pressure of all kinds. You rarely have a serious conversation in Afghanistan without somebody mentioning that we, quote-unquote, defeated the British, and we, quote-unquote, defeated the Russians, and we don't want all this foreign influence in our society. I think that it's partly there are communication issues here. You know, I'm not sure that we, by which I mean sort of the Western powers and interlocutors, are listening closely enough to what the Afghans think is possible to do and what's the right way to go about it.
Well, how do you interpret what they think is possible to do here?
Well, just from the conversations I've had, obviously, over the recent months and years, you know, I think what they think is possible is some sort of modus vivendi being established with the Taliban. And again, we have to sort of parse that a bit. I don't think anybody wants a modus vivendi with, you know, the sort of the bloodthirsty strategists at the top of the food chain who are training suicide bombers to come into villages and blow up schools and police stations. I don't know, nobody wants that. But most Afghans, this is a society of traders, of negotiators, of people who have traditionally changed sides at the drop of a hat. It's a country where people have always gotten along by consensus and by negotiation. And I think that, most Afghans feel that the only thing that's possible is to try and find a way to get along with these guys, at least those who are genuinely local and genuinely committed to their country. I mean, after all, we may disagree with their methods, but they are, by and large, not people that have some sort of global jihadist agenda. They are people who want to do exactly what they did 10, 15 years ago, which was to try to bring back some sort of, in their view, purer and better vision of Islam.
But as you say, there are those strategists at the top with goals that really get people's attention in Washington. Pamela Constable Martin Smith, stand by. Let me begin to bring our listeners in. Pete, in Boston, you're on the air, Pete.
Yeah, my question is, didn't we go there simply to disrupt, kill a few people, grab a few people, and make a statement that, you know what, if you continue to do what you're doing, here's what we can do. And if we have to come back, we can do more to you. So I'm saying, why all of a sudden now we're into this nation building, we want to build roads and bridges and institutions? I mean, they don't want us in the country. And I think we're getting lost here. I mean, we should just keep it simple. Go in there, do what we intended to do, and leave. As long as we continue to add on all these different things, it's going to become harder and harder to find the end game and get out with our heads held high. And I think we're going to get bogged down. We're just getting off of course here. We just need to do what we set out to do and get out. Afghans, they'll handle their issues. We can't build their country for them, you know what I'm saying? They don't want us there because they've had dealt with colonialism, and as long as we're there, they're going to see us as an occupying force. Keep it simple, get out.
Pete, we hear it. Let me take it to my guest, Martin Smith. How do you hear that? And does that sound like some version of what Vice President Joe Biden is saying? We can't do all this. Let's just go after Al-Qaeda. Is that possible, Martin?
Well, I was going to say that sounded like it was the vice president calling. I think that this is the question. What is our objective here? What are we trying to accomplish? And how can you really do nation building in a country that has had no tradition of a strong central government, where we don't speak the language, we don't understand much of the sort of human terrain, power is so localized from one valley to the next? Have we taken on too much? It is true that we did go in there to rid the country of al-Qaeda, to get the Taliban playing host to al-Qaeda out of there. That was accomplished. They went across the border into the tribal areas of Pakistan, and now we're engaged in a nation-building strategy in you could argue, two countries. In both Afghanistan and Pakistan.
But the question that comes up is, can these be separated? Pam talks about the bloodthirsty strategists at the top of the Taliban food chain that may indeed intersect with al-Qaeda. Can you let some milder wing of Taliban take over in Afghanistan or take significant power there and not empower those at the top who may indeed still be very deliberate allies of al-Qaeda? Does it look like that can be done, Martin?
Well, I have the same question as you're posing. I think it's correct that you have to find some way to negotiate with the Taliban. But what do you do about Mullah Omar or the Haqqani Network based in Pakistan, have historically received support from Pakistani intelligence services as a proxy force for protecting their interests within Afghanistan? It gets very complex very quickly. And what will a new order after you've negotiated with the, let's say, moderate Taliban within Afghanistan, what will that order do with these forces that are operating from sanctuaries inside Pakistan? I think that nobody knows exactly what's going to happen there. The idea is to isolate them, and that's probably the right direction to move, but I don't think anybody can make guarantees about how that will play out.
Pam Constable, you've talked about there being no good options here, about the United States, in effect, looking for the least bad option. do you see an option here of, I don't know, drones and smart bombs just keeping track of al-Qaeda and the rest sort of, I don't know, devil take the hindmost, Taliban, some wing thereof, it's yours, and, you know, we're, I'm not sure what, out or just in the cities?
Yeah, I would hate to see it reduced to that stark choice. I don't think that idea of, you know, using drones to take out two or three guys and then, you know, letting the rest of the chips fall where they may, I think that would be a tragedy because it would, in a sense, be the acknowledgement of the failure of, you know, 8 years of huge amounts of effort, of money, of donations, of support by troops, of many nations involved in trying to improve and help Afghanistan. I wanted to pick up on something your caller said, your mm-hmm. last caller, which mm-hmm. I thought was really important. He said, you know, they don't want us here. Why do we keep building bridges and roads and schools and let's just get out? I agree with what he said. You know, when you ask Afghans what they want, they don't talk about roads and schools and bridges and clinics. They talk about two things, security and justice. Those are the two things that Afghans tell you over and over that they want. And I do think that, going back to the issue of middle ground, if there's a way to bring security with some sort of, you know, moderate, sustaining international force and, as of course is being contemplated, a much more robust buildup of Afghan security forces, which we can also talk about separately, that would bring security. And then the second component would be justice. Now, the Taliban's great political strength is that they do bring justice of a kind to the regions where there has been very, very little provided by the current government. If there could be a way to strengthen that, if, as the Marines and the American officials have talked about, try to bring in justice administrations on the heels of military clearance of Taliban areas, if that could actually happen, and so far it hasn't happened, but if there could be a way with different sorts of surges to bring in some sort of rudimentary state-sponsored justice to these rural areas to provide more robust and enduring security, I think that is the bare minimum and the bottom line, and that the Afghans would find that not only acceptable, but a great relief, and it wouldn't require doing all this sort of building and other stuff that people have been doing so far. Maybe that is the middle ground.
Martin Smith, how does that sound to you? General McChrystal saying, look, we can't maintain the status quo. If you don't want mission failure, we need a lot more troops. Is there a middle ground? Is it only available with a big American troop surge? Does it sound like it could work if that was there?
Yeah, I don't know how you can expect the Afghan people, having gone through the election that they've just gone through and seen clear evidence of fraud on the part of the Karzai administration, how you can get loyalty of any kind or faith or trust in the central government. And if you're going to push out into these provinces and bring some kind of form of governance in the form of security, in the form of justice, you've got tremendous barriers in terms of how the people view the center. You know, I spent some time with police being trained, and I was asking one of the trainers how much the police were paid, and he says $150 a month. I said, how much is the cost of living per month? He said, about $300. Well, you've got a recipe right there for failure, for corruption. And as we know, corruption is rife among the police, less of a problem in the army. But we're way behind in the development of the police force, doing better on the army, but way behind overall in terms of enough forces to really secure the rural areas and provide the kind of things that I agree the Afghans want, security and justice.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the looming Afghanistan decision from the White House and the reality it faces on the ground in Afghanistan, in neighboring Pakistan. We're joined this hour by Pamela Constable of the Washington Post. She has spent years in this region, now based in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Martin Smith is with us, correspondent at the heart of the new Frontline PBS documentary, Obama's War airing tonight a very compelling picture of what U.S. troops are up against there. Martin Smith's cameras are all over one very tough town on the kind of Taliban frontier in Helmand province, but he also sits down with big players in Obama's war. Here he's talking again to General Stanley McChrystal, who's asked for more troops for Afghanistan. Smith reminds him that the U.S. forces cleared Helmand province three times, and the Taliban always came back. Here's General McChrystal's observation.
Once you clear something and don't hold it, you probably didn't really clear it. It has no staying power. In fact, I would argue that it's worse because you create an expectation and then you dash it. And so I think that you're almost better to have not gone there at all.
Maybe better not going, having gone at all. But he wants more troops to do it and, I guess, do it right this time. Gene in New Haven, Connecticut. Gene, you're on the air.
Thank you. You know, during the campaign, President Obama kept saying the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. That's what we've done in Afghanistan since 1980. We went in, we gave them the military aid, and they kicked out the Soviet Union. Instead of helping them, the country had been decimated. Instead of helping them build roads and schools and hospitals, we pulled out, the military part was over. When we went in 03, we told them, this time we're not going to abandon you. This time we're here to stay. We went in, we stayed for a little while, we went to Iraq. And now we're in there doing, you know, it's not really clear what we're doing. Whatever we have to do, we owe it to them, actually, at this point. Help them rebuild. Help them get infrastructure. Help them with roads and hospitals and schools. But get out militarily, and that's what we should do in Iraq, too. It's the only way to get goodwill. It might not get goodwill, but it's certainly better than keeping the country occupied.
Gene, thanks for your call. Let me put it to Pam, Constable Pam. We owe it to them to rebuild, but maybe get out militarily. Is that an option? We heard at the top of the hour from Laura King in Kabul saying already civilian, workers from around the world can't really go out into the field. It's the security just isn't there to do it, Pam.
I think that's right. There is a real conundrum of sort of the chicken and the egg of you can't do security without development, and you can't do development without security. And that's become a serious problem in the South, in the East, and increasingly in other parts of Afghanistan. I don't think you can do one without the other, and that, you know, again, it's a kind of a tragic situation. But if there's a way, and I'm just sort of, you know, we're all scrambling here to try to figure out options, if there's a way to improve the security to a certain extent, then there ought to be a way for Afghans to get out there and start doing the rebuilding. One of the big problems is that they still don't have the capacity to do that. It is still in a place like Helmand, for instance. I visited Helmand recently with the U.S. ambassador, former General Eikenberry, and you know, we were with Marines who were, you know, going into these districts and clearing them out and saying, okay, we want to be followed by the civilian infrastructure, the civilian wherewithal to do things, but they were having difficulty making that happen, finding people to bring, finding places for them to live, finding buildings for people to work in because everything had been destroyed. It's the second step is a particularly hard one, to make that transition, to Afghanize this conflict, not only because of the difficulty of building up an army that's already skimmed off the cream of the recruit crop and is now digging deeper into a population that is largely illiterate and not equipped to fight a modern war. So digging in deeper there, trying to find ways to build the Afghan capacity to go into these districts and begin to show people that there is an alternative. That all needs to be done, and it all needs to be done with Afghans, but there's a big gap between where we are now and saying, okay, let's just get out and let the Afghans do it. It's not possible yet.
Martin Smith, let's say, take the village where your cameras were in Helmand province, Minpochte village there. Let's say the troop surge comes through. Let's say there were twice as many Marines there. Did it look to your eyes, to the eyes what you were seeing through the camera that, let's say with twice as many, they could do it? It was so bleak. The Taliban was so omnipresent around the village. I wonder if double the troop level would do the trick.
Well, double the troop level would
get you a little more ground, allow more Marines to base away from Mien Poshte out into some of the outer reaches of the area so that they could be closer to the population. Of course, many people in the population not trusting the soldiers, not wanting to be close to the Marines where the Taliban might mount attacks, keep moving away. So that's a hard problem to solve. And the problem of this second wave, which is so important in getting Afghans in there or even a civilian surge of American civilian workers in there, that has not materialized because security isn't provided. And the job then falls on the soldiers or Marines, and they have to carry out these tasks of finding generators or, you know, building a school. And it puts an added burden on them for something that, you know, is pretty much outside their lane. But they have, you know, bravely taken on the task of providing all these services. You know, you talk about getting Afghans in there. Well, they're not even in where I was. There were not even very many Afghan soldiers or Afghan army attached to the unit I was with because there's a shortage of trained Afghan soldiers to come and be with them. So even before you get to an Afghan civilian surge, you've got to get Afghan soldiers in there, and they can't even get to that. So we're a long way from the scenario that that needs to be.
A big project there in itself. Charles in Falmouth, Massachusetts. Charles, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, for letting me speak on your program. Mm-hmm. First thing I wanted to do was to recommend to any listener that really wants to know a lot more about what's going on, Ahmed Rashid's excellent book, Descent into Chaos, recently published. My own background was working in the 1980s in Pakistan and into Afghanistan with the fundamentalist and non-fundamentalist parties, providing some medical support for Afghan children and for wounded Afghans. So I spent a lot of time among them.
With the Mujahideen in those days.
Yes, I was working with Hizb-e Islami of Ekmachar Gulbuddin and Yunus Khalis, different Hizb-e Islami. And I had a chance to meet Afghans and on occasions was under fire from Soviet.
How does that leave you seeing the situation now, Charles? Where does that leave your view now?
I don't believe that Taliban can be defeated because they are highly motivated by nascent Pashtun nationalism, the idea, the vision of creating a Pashtunistan state, by their culture, which is called the Pakhtunwali, which is highly xenophobic and doesn't want any foreign influence, even foreigners coming in to help, so that the hearts and minds of the Pashtun people cannot be won over. They are also highly motivated by fundamentalist Islam, which, if you are not a Muslim, ranks human beings on the same level or non-believers on the same level with dogs, dead people, and feces. They will not negotiate in good faith. They have the right not to. It is their custom not to negotiate with infidels. And then, finally, the support of the Pakistan ISI intelligence and Pakistan Army, for 15 years they have provided the training and the weapons and the ammunition and the funds. This, I'm not sure whether this can change now. So I think my proposal would be to move out of the Pashtun areas, to try to come to some kind of an agreement with them, which I don't think is possible, to let them govern themselves with whatever harshness according to their own customs, and that we should work with other minorities within Afghanistan, such as the Hazara, the Tajik, and possibly the Uzbek, help, who I think would be more responsive to Western help and Western development if it was done with small Western presence through locals as much as possible.
Charles, let us pick up your proposal. Pam Constable, how about it? The Pashtuns, a lost cause to foreign interveners, Charles says, and maybe, you know, make alliance with other groups in Afghanistan. I mean, there's already talk about the danger of a basically ethnically based civil war in Afghanistan. But is there some different alliance of different ethnic alliances that foreign troops powers might strike?
I'm afraid that suggestion is a recipe for disaster and for terrible conflict. If there's one thing that Afghans agree that they are most afraid of, it's not the Taliban, it's not Al-Qaeda, It's a return to 1992. It's a return to the incredible cruelty and viciousness of the Civil War, which, as you recall, was fought among Islamic militias, all of whom were Afghan, but whose driving motivation and passion was their own ethnic and regional and personal power. And many Afghans that I've talked to are terrified that opening up that can of worms could happen again. Right now there's concern that militias are being armed, that local and regional and militias from the other ethnic groups are now being armed to fight the Taliban. Many people are afraid of that. That's why there's so much, or has been so much hope for the Afghan National Army, because it's trained in the ethos of supporting a central state rather than any sort of regional or local boss. So I think that any attempt to arm or to work with ethnic minorities or ethnic groups would be extremely dangerous. I think it would make the problem much worse.
Martin Smith, in Helmand Province, could you imagine how U.S. troops might begin to cooperate with the Taliban if there's some strategy of engagement here? Our caller says it won't work. But given what you saw, is there a way the Taliban would step up out of the, you know, gullies and shadows and work with these American representatives?
I think right now the Marines that were there that I spent time with were trying to figure out who was shooting at them. It's a heroin poppy growing region. There are criminal gangs. There's just disgruntled locals that may or may not pledge loyalty to Taliban leadership. It's even unclear down there. I think U.S. intelligence is very weak on understanding exactly who they're fighting in different regions, different parts of the country. So I think we're a step away from even understanding who to reach out to. One of the problems we keep talking about, the Taliban, and Pam mentioned before that you can't think of them as a foreign interloper here. This is an indigenous movement. Mm-hmm. And in many places, the Taliban are the people. And so the idea of separating the people from the Taliban and then somehow negotiating with the Taliban is, again, a lot more difficult in practice than it is in theory.
Pam Constable, behind all this looms Pakistan. In your reporting and certainly in Martin's documentary, Obama's War, Pakistan in many ways seems like the real heart of the problem. And Afghanistan looks more or less insoluble if something isn't done about Pakistan, which looks even more insoluble, Pam.
Well, I'm not sure that Pakistan is more insoluble, but it's certainly a much bigger country with much more at stake. I think its position sort of strategically and as a central focus of the region makes it there's much more to lose and much more to win in Pakistan. I think Afghanistan, we all have to recognize, is a country that's been through absolute hell, and everyone is starting over there from scratch. Pakistan is a much bigger, much richer, much more developed country. It has one of the world's largest and best-equipped armies. It has much more at stake, and I think that there's a tendency now to view sort of Afghan and Pakistan sort of in one breath and as if there's one solution to the problem in both countries. I would disagree with that, and I would say that there has to be a very different approach to Pakistan. The Pakistanis have this enormous sense of national pride and sovereignty. They don't want foreign troops there at all. They barely tolerate these drone attacks. You know, they can't really be pushed around, and they certainly can't be occupied. The only hope is to try and use aid and the carrots and sticks of aid, which is happening right now, to try and make sure that they become real, bona fide, good faith partners, which, as others have been pointing out, has not always been the case. They've always had this sort of double-track policy of keeping the Taliban as a reserve force to gain strategic depth because, as you know, Pakistan, traditionally, and up even as we speak, even as you've got suicide bombs going off across the country, Pakistanis still see the major threat to their existence as India. not Islamic fundamentalism, not Afghanistan, not the Taliban, not even Al-Qaeda. And until that begins to change, until Pakistan can be pressured and persuaded that it really needs to put its money where its mouth is, we have its leaders saying, yes, we realize that there's enormous threat from these forces. Until it starts to really acting on that, just to really start to act on that concern, then I don't think we're going to see enough change. But it is such a different country from Afghanistan. I do think there has to be a different approach.
Martin Smith, you took your cameras to Pakistan as well. Candor seemed to be in short supply there. We've just got a minute, but the Pakistan background to the Afghan conflict surely hangs over this decision facing the White House.
Yeah, well, I think that candor is lacking in Pakistan. You know, I've been in and out of there since 2002. And one thing that people seem to be giving them credit for is going after the Taliban that are threatening the state of Pakistan. And that is kind of a no-brainer for the Pakistanis. They do face a serious Taliban problem of their own. But what they're not willing to do yet is to take on the Taliban that are coming across the border. And that is a key difference, because it's those Taliban that have sanctuaries there that continue to kill and harm NATO and American troops.
And there's the picture, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and enormous challenges as the White House tries to figure out exactly what comes next. We're grateful for the detail to fill out the picture. Around some of the detail around the picture, around the decision going on the table in Washington. Pam Constable with the Washington Post, it's always great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us today, Pam.
It's been my pleasure.
And Martin Smith, correspondent at the heart of the Frontline PBS documentary Obama's War, premiering tonight. It is something to see. I recommend it. Martin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.